welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde. That is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Last week, we shared the story of Ryan Richter, an amazing guitarist who just put out his first solo album. Today, I'm talking to someone who has put out numerous great albums over the years and then took a really long hiatus, and I'm happy to say is getting back into it. I'm chatting with my dear friend, singer-songwriter John Roderick of the Long Winters and Western State Hurricanes. I've known John for a really long time. We're talking like 25 years. I've opened for John's band at least once or twice. We're talking 1997, 1998 here. I've watched John's entire music career unfold, and over the last decade or so, it's been an inspiration to watch him become a professional podcaster. John hosts Omnibus with Ken Jennings of Jeopardy fame. He's also the guy behind Roderick on the Line. He had the Friendly Fire War movie podcast for a while. And John has a Patreon now with its own podcast inside the Patreon feed. John lives here in Seattle, Washington. He's collaborated with all sorts of great musicians over the years, including Amy Mann. He wrote a song called The Commander Thinks Aloud about the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster that I think is one of the greatest songs written about a historic event ever done. Back in 2017, John was crowned King Neptune at Seattle's Seafair Festival, which is a very Seattle-ish badge of honor. And as is probably clear by now, he's always been one of the most fascinating people I've been lucky enough to know. Over the last few months, through social posts and even some text messages to me, I've seen John get back into music in a big way. There's a Long Winters Rarities album that just came out called So Good at Waiting. He's been building out not one, but seemingly multiple pedal boards. He's been buying gear. There's talk of a residency at a local theater here in Seattle. I wanted to talk to John about all this. I think for many of you out there, if you're of a certain age, there's some themes here that might be universal. Putting your career and family above your music dreams. There's a lot to digest here. I hope you enjoy it. This was a fun one for me. If we can make it work, I want John to come to our Fretboard Summit in Chicago, where you all can see the likes of Blake Mills and Joe Henry, and Colin Hay, and Valerie June, and last week's podcast guest, Ryan Richter, along with so many people from the industry and YouTube fame and guitar makers. Josh Scott's going to be there. Rhett Scholl will be there. Chris Martin IV is coming. We're going to have a Vintage Amps room once again, as we did last year for fans of the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, and so many fun surprises. So I hope you can come. Go to fretboardsummit.org to register while you can. We still have a limited batch of tickets for the three-day All Access passes. And of course, if you want to come and go guitar shopping, go to the Midwest's largest luthery and pedal and amp showcase, you can. But I'd love to see you at some of the incredibly cool Fretboard Summit programming that we have brewing. We have some sponsors for this podcast. I want to tell you all about them. Peghead Nation, my favorite music construction portal around. You can get your first month free or $20 off any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. Isotope is offering you 10% off of their products with the discount code FRET10. Stringjoy Strings, the new cool guitar and mandolin string company, are letting you have 10% off your first order at stringjoy.com with the promo code Fretboard. Sumac is sponsoring the show once again, the one place where pretty much every guitar builder I've ever talked to orders from. They have tools, they have parts, they have everything you could ever imagine, guitar building kits, amp building kits, you name it. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. And last, but definitely not least, we're talking about Seattle on this week's podcast. We're also talking about buying gear. And Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar is sponsoring the show once again. The coolest array of vintage acoustics, electric synths, pedals, and amps you'll find under one roof. They're in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood. They have a full-service repair and restoration shop. Their crew is so cool, and the store has such a great vibe. You can go hang out there or hang out on their web presence at mmguitarbar.com or on Instagram. Those are our sponsors. Our 54th issue is wrapped up. Our printer and binding company are doing their magic. It's going to be hitting mailboxes fairly soon, so if you haven't subscribed yet, do so now, and I'll make sure you get a copy before they sell out at fretboardjournal.com. Now, here is my chat with John Roderick. John Roderick, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here in your palatial... It's like the craziest studio here. It's a basement, but it has lots of natural light, and it's like massive 20-foot ceilings. You don't get a lot of basement studios with 20-foot ceilings.
You should see the office Christmas tree every year. It's just huge. Very narrow, very, very tall. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, about time. In fact.
Well, you probably don't even remember this. Hopefully you don't. Hopefully nobody tries to seek this out. But the very earliest incarnation of a Fretboard Journal podcast took place like 15, 16 years ago.
Wow.
And you were on it. This was before you became a podcast entrepreneur yourself.
Right.
Do you remember that?
My first podcast was 2011. So it would have been before that?
Yeah. I think it was before
that. Well, tell me about it. This is a wonderful trip down memory lane.
Well,
trip down lack of memory
the
lane.
The Fretboard Journal's roster of editors back then, Michael and Mark and myself, had a podcast that was on a platform. It has to be defunct by now, but it's called Blog Talk Radio. And it was a very ahead of its time, yet primitive at the same time, thing that was like basically a Zoom for that era where people could call into a conference number line and it would record. And there was a very primitive way to mix or add in audio files. The problem was it sounded completely atrocious. And we had you call in. And this is where it was at. Maybe you'll remember this part, or maybe...
Was I pretending to be just a rando, or was I?
Well, you were John Roderick of the Long Winters, okay, pre-podcasting, and you at that time had, you know, I forget when the last Long Winters official record was.
2006.
You were at a point where you were describing trying to break out of writer's block by, if I'm remembering correctly, you were either recording the entire instrumental part of songs that didn't have lyrics yet, or maybe something involving loops. Would either of those things be true?
Both things were true.
Okay.
And neither thing was actually my process. And it did not result in a fourth Long Winters full length. I have a recorded 14 song album, completely recorded, just no vocals. And it sits there. It basically sits there in the entryway to my house as it's a ghost shaped thing. It's like the Family Circus Not Me ghost. And it stands there every time I walk out of the house and it's like, not me. And I go, you little bastard. Okay. I could finish it today. You and I could go out to my house and I could finish that record today.
Yeah. You just need lyrics.
I have lyrics.
Oh, okay.
I just hit that. You know what it was the other day? I've been working on some songs lately.
Well, I want to get to that. Okay. Yeah. But what was it? You were about to tell me something.
What I should have done was take those songs, which I'd written on loops and recorded, or written as loops and recorded with the full band and with John Goodmanson.
Okay.
I should have then broken those back down to acoustic guitar and got my old Yamaha out and relearned my own tunes the way I would play them if I were playing, you know, a solo show.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think guitar in my hands, if I'd had that, my old Yamaha, I think I would have found it very easy to, or if not easy, normal to write them as songs because I'd be playing the acoustic guitar. I wouldn't be listening to a symphonic mix of 40 tambourine parts that I looped.
Yeah.
I would just be sitting with, because that's how you write a song, is with an acoustic guitar, or at least I do.
Yeah.
But I never thought to do it. I had this incredible music. I thought, I mean, that's all Michael Stipe ever gets. Michael Stipe doesn't sit and write a song. Peter Buck gives him a full tune.
Sure.
And Peter Buck gives him 40 full tunes.
Uh-huh.
He picks the ones he likes and he sings unintelligibly over the top of them. And I thought, that's what I should be doing. I want to sing unintelligibly over the top of a fully composed tune. And there are so many front men that do that. I don't think Anthony Kiedis picks up a guitar, does he? No.
You're asking the wrong guy.
I think those guys just sit in a practice space and somebody goes, and then somebody else goes, and then he goes, shabba-doo-dabba-doo-doo. But that's not how I write.
Yeah.
And I didn't respect my own process.
Yeah.
And here it is 15 years later.
Yeah.
And I haven't put out really any like a full length of new songs in that whole time.
But you're raising a daughter. You've got a successful podcast career.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's nobody harder on me than me.
Life turned out okay. Yeah.
Oh, I'm fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a creative person,
yeah.
I'm noticing this a lot. A lot of people that I know in their 50s now who had pretty good music careers in their 20s and 30s. And then I think psychologically just felt like, well, it's over, mm-hmm. right? I'm 40 years old. Like, I can't be in there competing with EDM bands.
Yeah.
And they all sort of fucked off into their own little families and eddies, right? Yep. Professional eddies. And now I'm seeing so many of us kind of come out of the woodwork and go, wait a minute, I'm still capable of all of this. I can play a rock show. I can, and there's an audience for me. And so it does feel like kind of a resurgence in Seattle, especially of indie rockers and even sort of post-grunge people. Like, let's get, if not the band back together, then let's at least all get together and see what happens.
So you and I talk pretty regularly, but seldom about music stuff. Sometimes we'll run into each other. One of the few things you've told me in the last couple months, music-wise, is you were trying to assemble an all Pacific Northwest or all Seattle-based pedal board.
Right.
So there is some momentum going on right now to record music, play music, do more live shows. What?
Well, what's interesting is I was, there's a guy named Dan Spills. I don't know if you've ever met
him. I know Daniel Spills very well.
Yeah. And Dan and I are both from Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah.
And we went to competing high schools.
Okay.
He went to West. I went to East. But Dan was friends with a lot of, you know, I was friends with people at West. And we both lived here in Seattle. He played in a couple of bands, the Supersonic Soul Pimps, and then in Mock Tube.
Yeah.
And we lived a few blocks from each other, and we've always been incredibly cordial, just like Anchorage friends, but never went to a second location together.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, apropos of nothing, he sent me a message saying, I'm having a party at my house. And the band and some iteration of the band Awesome is going to be there playing banjos or whatever.
Yeah.
It was last summer.
Okay.
Beautiful day. Stop by if you want. And I happened to be out with my daughter at that end of town. And I said, yeah, why don't we go by and see, we'll just stop by Dan Spills' house. It was in a neighborhood, Denny Blaine, that I know really well.
Sure.
We show up. I'd seen this house my whole life. He's got this wonderful house. Yeah. We go in. We're watching the band, who are great. Hang out with Dan. It's great. And by the end of the afternoon, I said, because he'd show me his studio in the basement. I said, hey, I've got these songs. Do you want to monkey around with them? And he said, yeah. Send me what you've got, because crucially, Dan's not a songwriter, right? I know so many musicians who are so gifted, but whatever the thing is about writing songs, that's just never what they did.
These weren't the same songs we were talking about a minute ago.
Nope. These are just puttering along. Okay. I was part of a book club and I wrote a song about David Copperfield for the Christopher Pizanza's book club.
Okay.
And I was like, I can still do this.
Okay.
You know, every once in a while I'll write a song.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, Amy Mann was making a record and I heard that a friend of mine had written a song for her album. And she and I had known each other a long time
and
toured together and stuff. And I wrote her and said, is it true that this guy wrote a song for your record? And she said, yeah, it's great. And I said, well, why the hell didn't I write a song for your record? And she said, well, go ahead. I mean, the record's done.
Yeah.
But if you write a song, a good song. And so I sat down and I was so mad.
Yeah.
That this other guy had gotten a song on an Amy Mann record. And I sat at the piano and I wrote one, sent it to her, and she put it on her album. And I was like, I can still do this. I can write songs. But then, of course, I didn't.
Okay.
And then, like, the next year.
Deadlines are good.
They're great. The next year, Gibbard.
Ben Gibbard, Death Cab for Cutie.
Writes, and he says, I've got this idea. We're going to write songs, 12 hours. You're going to write at your house. I'm going to write at my house.
Okay.
Eric Anderson from Cataldo is going to do this with us. The three of us are going to write these songs. We're going to write 12 songs in 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not bringing in anything that you worked on before. It's not some riff that you've got in your mind. You're just going to pick up the guitar. At the top of the hour, you're going to start working on a song, and you're going to have it recorded by the end of the hour and then immediately start on the next.
Okay.
And I said, it's 12 hours of my life. What, you know,
sure.
What am I afraid of? And so in our respective worlds, we started on this. None of us got past the ninth song. By nine songs, we were just spent.
Okay.
But the next day, we all three got together at Ben's and played our songs. Mm-hmm. And he did this thing where he was like, we'll play one of each of our tunes.
Okay.
But the way Ben writes, right, he's really gifted. He's got a decked out studio.
Sure.
So he was like, drum machine, and then he laid down a bass line, and then a guitar.
It was an album.
Yeah. And he's so good at that, right?
Yeah.
And what I was doing was with this Yamaha guitar, I had my phone, the like voice app.
Sure.
And I sang these songs in the voice app. So we call up his first song, just sounds like a Death Cab song.
Yeah.
My first song sounds like a guy who hasn't written a song in 4 years. Mm-hmm. Just screaming into this thing. But by song number five, I was in the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And writing a song in an hour and recording it, I got five of these nine songs that stood, that I could defend these tunes.
Yeah.
But I didn't do anything with them. They sat in the voice app on my phone.
Sure.
Anyway, so I sent a track to Dan. And I was like, I don't know how to work drum machines. I don't know any of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
You want to mess with it? And he and I started screwing around, and we got five songs out of this. I sent him just this bunkum.
From the hourly song challenge?
No.
Different.
Wow. At this point, I'm just throwing pieces together. I'm taking some of my little ideas. I've got lyrics over here. I throw them at him. Song about Emily from David Copperfield. I've got, this just hodgepodge of stuff. And he puts drums on it and plays piano on it. And all of a sudden I could take this track, put a band together, go into the studio, and by the end of the day have a recorded song that would sound like The Long Winters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really validating. And then there was that benefit show, the Smooch benefit.
Yes, here in Seattle, yeah.
And, Smooch is kind of a Nordstrom family benefit for the Children's Hospital that they do every year. And I got a call from Megan Jasper, who's, I guess, CEO? Is that what she is? Or CEO of Sub Pop.
Yeah.
For your listeners, she's the one that when the New York Times called Sub Pop in 1991 and said, what's going on? What's the scene? Give us some of the slang of grunge. Mm-hmm. She just sat, she was the receptionist. And she was the one that said, oh, yeah, well, here's some slang terms. when we're hanging out, it's called swinging on the flippity flop. And, you know, somebody with like stupid pants there, we call them wax lacks. And she just off the top of her head came up with 20.
Yeah.
And the Times printed it with no fact checking.
Yeah.
Just like, oh yeah, you know, the girl at Sub Pop told us. And now she's CEO.
Yeah.
But she called and was like, we're doing this benefit. Will you put the long winters together? And I said, there's no long winters. Everybody's living here and there and nobody's,
yeah.
We haven't played a show in 5 years. And she was like, oh, okay. Well, I figured you'd say that, but I had to try. And about an hour later, I get a text from Pete Nordstrom, mm-hmm. president of the titular company,
yes.
who's also a rock musician. And he said, if I put a band together that plays all the Long Winters music, will you do the show? And I said, I mean, that's never going to happen, right? Like,
sure.
But if you do, if all I have to do is show up in sunglasses and a cape and take the stage and you know all my songs and I just sing the lyrics, then I will absolutely do it.
Sure.
And about an hour after that, Mike Squires calls me.
Mm-hmm. Friend of our show.
Right.
Former or current Long Winters member. I don't know what we call him.
Yeah. Couch Riffs. Mike Squires. Uh-huh. Duff McKagan, bass player.
Ugly Kid Joe.
Currently on tour with Ugly Kid Joe in Europe. Squires calls me and he says, how did you Tom Sawyer me into putting a band together for you?
Oh.
And I said, I didn't do anything. Yeah. I didn't mention you at all. And he said, Pete Nordstrom just called me and told me he needed a Long Winters and that he wanted me to do it.
That's clever.
Pretty good of Pete Nordstrom.
That's pretty good.
And so Squires put together a band with Pete Nordstrom on the bass
mm-hmm.
and they learned the Long Winters music. I was not able to just show up in a cape. I had to go to practice.
The perils of being in a band.
But it was great. We got up on stage. We played 5 or 6 songs. It was really fun.
Yeah.
And then the Crocodile had a reunion and we played 5 or 6 songs at that.
Mm-hmm.
Different band, Musburger on drums. And okay. John Goodmanson played the guitar. First time he'd been on stage since, I think, 1990.
Wow.
I think he filled in on a Hader show or something was the last time he played guitar. Anyway, it got me really excited.
Yeah.
All of this stuff, right? Yeah. 55 years old, and all of a sudden I've just got all this energy. And it's admittedly energy from other 55-year-old losers who are sitting around like, God, I got all these guitars still.
Sure.
Yeah. I've got like 40 distortion boxes. What the hell am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
So it's been exciting. And I did go down and pull out all the bins, all the basement bins, and pulled out all the effects pedals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people our age remember a time when effects pedals were not really that, they weren't fetishized like they are now.
No, this is a whole new generation, yeah.
And so I have these bins of effects pedals, but I was never somebody that cared about effects pedals. My rig on the floor was always an overdrive.
Sure.
A line boost, mm-hmm. like a micro amp or some kind of linear power booster or whatever.
Yep.
And then a fuzz pedal and a delay pedal. 4 pedals.
Yeah.
And sometimes the boost was a compressor. But it was always that. It was 4 pedals and 3 of them were gain stages.
Yeah.
And none of them crazy gain stages. Just hit the top of your Fender Deluxe a little harder.
Yep.
But I open up these bins and I've got 80 effects pedals. 80.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not kidding. 80. Yeah. And they're every kind of thing. Apparently I have every Electro Harmonix big box effect from the 70s. And most of them just were either given to me or somebody sold it to me for $50.
Sure.
Because pedals were just meh.
Yeah.
And I never used an octave pedal on anything. Why do I have 4 of them?
Yeah.
I barely ever used chorus.
Yeah.
Why do I have 6 chorus pedals? And I got, and I, so I laid them all out on the floor and I realized, well, I have every Boss pedal you could ask for except a phaser.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, we're all insane now. We've so, as a culture and guitar people as a culture have lost the plot.
Yeah.
My reaction to this 80 pedals was not to say, I need to sell 60 of these.
Yeah.
It was, I need a Boss phaser. I need a Maxon, but not, you know, not a 90s reissue of a 70s Maxon. I need the, and I went on a pedal buying spree, the opposite of what I, and the thing was, it didn't make any sense, right? I was like, I have all these DOD, nine series or whatever, DOD pedals, Digitech pedals. But before the whole milk box era, back when they, it was just like FX60.
Yep.
And I, and they're not the DOD pedals from the 70s, the cool little ones. Yeah. These are the weird ones from the early 80s.
Yeah.
So basically what I was doing was recreating all the pedal boards I had or could have had in 1984.
Okay.
Top of the line, peak performance, 1984. None of, no boutique pedals, no pedals that anybody put any time or thought, it just all made in Japan.
Yeah.
And all made of metal.
Sure.
No plastic on any of them. And now, I don't know, I have 90 pedals.
Yeah.
And people were writing me and like, you know that Memory Man is worth $900.
Yeah.
And I was like, $900 for a Memory Man? But then I was at Jim Roth's house last week, and he has like nine memory men,
mm-hmm.
because it was part of his rig for all those years. Mm-hmm. I bet, you know, he's a great tech. I bet he, they all work.
Yeah.
But they're just, they're on a shelf, like hard plug, three prong plug memory men.
So for a generation, pedals are the new Lionel Railroad. what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's right. We're all old men and it's just like, oh, give me the, but then I look at people's pedal boards and they've got these pedals that have like 19 knobs on them.
Oh yeah. The new ones. Yeah. All Chase Bliss and all those crazy. Yeah.
And I'm like, if it's got more than three knobs, I'm baffled. Yeah. What else could you need besides tone, volume, gain?
Yeah.
And then if it's a chorus, it's like tone, speed, depth.
Yeah.
And beyond that, I'm, if it's a third, if it's a fourth option, like if I'm adjust, if I'm EQing it to mm-hmm. beyond just turning a tone pedal from dark to light, I don't know how to do that. I don't, what are you asking me to do? You're asking me to understand the things I'm doing and I don't.
Yeah. But what I'm hearing is you were a full-time musician and then 15 years of ambivalence, malaise, writer's block, whatever. And then the light at the end of the music tunnel was these self-imposed deadlines and exercises with Ben Gibbard. So what does this surplus of pedals coming out of the Tupperware do? Are you writing again or are you just playing around? Does it distract you from the task at hand?
So the pedals have absolutely distracted me.
Okay.
Right. I was working on music every day and I was sending tracks back and forth to Dan and I was playing now shows.
Yeah.
And I had, and I was talking to the people at the Rabbit Box about putting on a monthly show.
Yeah.
And really feeling like this is a good time for me to start doing this stuff again.
Yeah.
And it isn't just writer's block. It's like after all those years on tour, I didn't want to get back in the van.
Yeah,
I just saw drive-by truckers tour routing for this year, all of June, and you know, and little bit bleeding into the months on either side, and then all of October.
Yeah,
and I'm picturing them, you know, even on a bus, probably on a bus.
Sure.
Right? Drive-by truckers. But I'm picturing that like 2 months of the year, you're going to be out every night, mm-hmm. you know, with one night off every five. And I just got, my back started to hurt just in sympathy, right? I felt like going into the kitchen and getting a deli tray that was kind of, where the meat was kind of sweaty and just like trying to make a sandwich out of it.
Yeah.
So I don't want to do that.
No.
And I have a little bit of stage anxiety and always have. Mm-hmm. It's just when you're playing every night, your stage anxiety just sort of tumbles into tomorrow's stage anxiety.
Yeah.
But now if you tell me I'm playing a show in a month, I'll just sit and fret about it. It'll get worse and worse the closer I get to it.
It's better to tell you you have a show in 3 hours.
And I said that to the rabbit box. I was like, look, the more time you give me to plan, the worse time I'll have.
Okay.
If you told me I was interviewing Lydia Lunch tonight and we were going to play 5 songs, I'd be like, great. I won't go home because that will just throw me off. I'll just stay here in the green room and play whatever instrument you give me. And I would be so comfortable doing that, right? Like, give me no time to think about it.
Yeah.
But if it's like you're putting a show together with Lydia Lunch and it's next month, it's just...
The anticipation.
Oh my God, awful.
Okay.
But so all the gear stuff has put me then at one remove from the work I was doing, which was trying to actually, I think, try to get songs together for a record.
Yeah.
I don't even know now if you make records.
I was going to say, yeah.
Just put out a Nabil, Long Winter's drummer, and what is his job now?
4AD president?
No, he went up. He's like Beggar's Banquet.
Oh,
American president.
Okay.
But former Long Winter's drummer, I sent him a couple of songs and he sent me back a 3-page, here's what you do in 2024. And he had it down to the week, like, and then this week you go to KEXP with your new song and then you put it online and then you make a little video for it and then you send all your subscribers a personal note with a Hershey's kiss. And then you do this and then you do, because he does this all day, right?
Yeah.
He's doing this for
new bands.
All these bands.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's an awful lot to, I need to hire an assistant, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully she'll wear a pencil skirt and have a clipboard and her hair up in a high bun.
Sure.
But that's probably not what's going to happen.
No.
Because in order to hire her, I would have to go through the steps where I would basically need an assistant to hire my assistant. I'd need some sort of task rabbit to like read people's bios or whatever. But then here's the problem with the effects pedals. Okay. I reached the level where it's like, I've even got a Boss acoustic simulator.
Oh yeah.
Because one time I read an interview with River Phoenix.
Yeah.
No, not River Phoenix.
Cuomo?
Rivers Cuomo.
Yeah.
And he said, oh man, the secret in my pedal board is the Boss acoustic simulator. Because nobody expects the acoustic guitar to come out of whatever my Telecaster is. And I can put in the acoustic parts.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's genius. I'm going to get an acoustic simulator. And you know, you can buy those for $40 all day long, anywhere in the world. That's not one of the pedals anybody cares about.
Yeah, that's not cool yet.
And you know, it's got a little price tag on it still, like a little sticker, $40. And I still haven't quite figured out how to do it. But then I got my amps out.
Okay.
And I realized I really love 5 and 10 watt amps.
Yeah.
I don't have very many amps that are more than 15 or 20, right? My touring rig was always a Deluxe and an AC-15.
Sure.
And I've got a Blonde Bassman. You know, I've got some big amps. In the Western State Hurricanes, I used a Trainer YBA-1A. That was the loudest amp anybody in town had.
Yeah.
And clean. Loud, clean.
Yeah.
Because my tone was always clean.
Yeah.
Loud and clean. But that Trainer, you know, you needed a hand cart to move it.
Yeah. That's like 18 watts or whatever.
No, God, that more. YBA 2A.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this, it was a 71 or something like that. The transformer was big. It was big as a basketball.
Yeah.
But I haven't used, and I had a Carvin. I mean, I had all kinds of crazy stuff in the 90s.
Yeah.
But I was like, 15 watt amps are too big. I need 10 watt amps. I need 5 watt. What am I doing with these 15 watt amps? And so I went on a fucking amp nut job.
Yeah, you wanted to be on our amp podcast.
I did.
You still can.
I thought that's what this was. What is this podcast?
Skip doesn't leave Chico or where he's from much, but this is the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, so I sent an email to Chris Benson.
Yes.
And I said—
Benson Amps, Portland, Oregon.
That's right. And I said, hey, you know, I played one of your amps because I have a Benson amp.
Okay.
I have a Monarch that was one of the first ones he built. Like it's all like written in pencil type of thing. It's got that old couch upholstery ticking fabric. And it's not the new Monarch. It doesn't have any of the bells and whistles. It's really got two knobs. It's like volume and tone.
Yeah.
But it's too big. Mm. It's, what is the Monarch? It's 15, 20 watts.
Yeah.
So I have played that live. I played that live for the Western State Hurricanes reunion.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote him and I was like, I want one of your 5 watt amps. And he said, all right, I'll make you a Vinny Jr.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, but you know, I know everybody's into your shit right now. You're like the big hot guy.
He is the big, yeah.
So I'm like, I want it to be special. I want you to make it for me so that it's like cool and special. So it's not just something I buy in a store.
You want a preferential treatment.
Give me something. Like, and he was like, all right, what do you want? And I said, well, here's the other thing. I don't know what I want.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to have to pick anything. I want you to pick what color it is, what it does.
Okay.
But just do something special because I'm a special flower and I want one of your special things. Like at one point Gibson, Seattle had a Gibson dealership here.
Showroom, yeah.
The showroom run by Jenny Marsh.
Yes.
Who is friends to everyone.
Yes.
And the Long Winters were one of Gibson's endorsees during the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always down at the Gibson showroom having a great time. But Gibson was doing that thing where they're like, we're not going to give guitars to anybody, but we'll loan you guitars as long as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was touring with these R9, you know, Les Paul 59 standards guitars. Even then I couldn't have afforded.
Sure.
Right. $4,000 guitars, which now I don't know, like a 2006 R9. They're expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's like Emerald City Guitars expensive, but I had them on tour and I was taking them all over and it was genius because they had places in Europe. Mm. They had showrooms in Europe. So I didn't have to take guitars.
That is clever. Yeah.
I would just show up in London or show up in Madrid and there would be a Les Paul waiting for me and someone really happy to give it to me. You know, their Spanish gal, hand me this 59 and I'd tour with it and then I'd give it back to her before I got on the airplane. Totally just the dopest arrangement.
Yeah.
But I wanted an acoustic guitar and I didn't want to borrow it. I really wanted it to be mine. And so they were like, well, we can get you guitars. And I said, the one I want though, you don't make it anymore. I want a country and Western, which you don't make, but you do make it basically. It's the Sheryl Crow signature model.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry to say this, I love Sheryl Crow, but I don't want to have a Sheryl Crow signature model guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to just be a Gibson Country and Western guitar, which is what she wanted and had.
Yeah.
But then Gibson puts her name on it.
Yeah.
And they said, we can do that. So they made me basically a Sheryl Crow, but in the label inside, they typed Gibson Country and Western, spelled it all out. You know, it's like too big for the label, which I feel is that's what I want. That's what I want from Chris Benson. I want everybody to make me a thing that doesn't exist otherwise.
Sure.
It's a small thing. It's not like I want an inlaid fretboard with a dragon that says my name.
Yeah.
Just a little thing that I know it's special. And I was playing with Jeff Fielder.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at the guitar. I took it out of the case and he said, "Is that a Sheryl Crow signature model?" Because he'd been playing guitar with Sheryl Crow. And I was like, "It is, damn you." But it doesn't say so anywhere. So I got called out there. But so right now I'm waiting on my Benson.
Okay.
And I was thinking, well, I got to get rid of all these 15 watt amps. They're too big.
Yeah.
You know, I want amps that I can carry two of them at a time. And it's just like I'm carrying two briefcases.
Yeah.
And then again, our friend Mike Squires said, "You're an idiot. The Fender Deluxe and the AC-15 you're never not going to want them."
Sure.
"They are the workhorses. You're not always going to be able to get by with a 5-watt amp or even 2 5-watt amps."
Mm-hmm.
But then Squires has got a closet full of SVTs and Soldanos and, you know, like whatever, that Eddie Van Halen 5150.
Yeah, he's got it all.
Head on top of a 412 cabinet. So I don't know if I'd trust him, but. So none of this has anything to do with writing songs, though. Right now I'm on an amp quest.
Okay.
And I feel it. It's a disease, or not a disease. It's a sign of cultural sickness that we have all, despite years of not wanting to be consumers, especially rock musicians who generally, at least in our era, espoused a kind of non-consumer, anti, if not anti-capitalist, at least like DIY, you know, the whole premise of, what's the magazine from Portland that's all about DIY recording?
Tape Op.
Yeah. The whole Tape Op premise was just like, "Hey man, just string a rubber band between two oil cans and stick a mic inside of your car glove compartment, and that's the tone of your kick drum." And I subscribe to that.
Yeah.
But now everybody I know, myself included, is like, "Oh man, I need another $3,500 practice amp in order to make my vintage 80s DOD pedals sound the most righteous on songs I haven't finished."
Yeah. All right.
What do you mean, all right? Are you looking at your watch? Have I just been talking nonstop?
No, I mean, you're a great storyteller, and I want more John Roderick songs to come out of the woodwork. So I hope that one of these things triggers that.
Yeah. I think the thing that has inhibited me the most is not knowing how to release music.
Hmm.
You know, Barsook, my record label,
sent
out a message to us all last year saying, "We're not putting out any new records."
Oh, I didn't know that.
"We're just going to sell our old catalog."
Okay.
And so, you know, and I wrote and said, "Oh, this is bad timing because I'm writing new songs." And we all had a good laugh.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what, I don't get paid any money from streaming services.
No.
And Bandcamp does send a little money over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of my royalties come from my songs getting played in Brazil on some weird, because European countries and South American countries actually pay for
interesting
plays in ways that Americans don't. And then, just like SAG-AFTRA style, some song got used in a film or a TV show, and it's always just generating money.
Yeah.
But to put out a song now, I don't know what exactly to do. I'm not organized.
Mm-hmm.
So to be responsible to like put it online somehow across all streaming services, I mean, I'm already bored just saying those words. Bored enough that I won't do the 10 steps that it requires to do.
Yeah.
And so I'm living in a world of Patreon.
Yeah.
Where I could just put it on Patreon.
Yeah.
But that doesn't quite feel like a like a record.
No, it's kind of walled off or whatever they, however they describe it. Yeah.
And that's been inhibiting me for a long time. And I know it probably inhibits other people my age. Because I don't know what it would be like put a song out on YouTube.
Yeah.
I've met plenty of musicians who have whole careers and they never once played a black box theater.
Yeah.
They've never once sat in a dressing room that smells like bleach. They put up a song on YouTube and it got 1 billion views and now they can play The Moor.
Mm-hmm.
And that backstage doesn't smell like bleach.
Yeah.
That backstage has the couches are still bad, but probably. It's got hummus, right?
Yeah.
The meat in the deli tray isn't sweating.
Yeah.
And I admire them, but I don't, I'm not a native to that. And it shouldn't inhibit me from writing songs. It shouldn't be part of the thinking at all. It shouldn't have been even back when it was like get in the van.
Yeah.
Because you drive yourself crazy. Like, oh, what kind of interview am I going to do for the St. Louis Riverfront Times? It's like, that doesn't matter. You haven't written the songs yet. What are you worried about what Pitchfork's going to say? But now there's that extra technology. Maybe you're the guy that's going to tell me.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, I don't know, I'm not going to play a song therapist here, but it sounds like the process is part of the equation for you. And the process of maybe getting in the van or figuring out the pedal board is obvious. I mean, I think for anyone, it'd be more exciting than thinking about like, well, I guess I need to log into DistroKid and come up with an account. Like, it's way more fun to think about pedals and 5-watt amps.
Yeah, way more fun.
And back in the day, you didn't even have to think about DistroKid. The rest kind of just happened, or at least happened because you had a label. And
if you had people, a label, yeah. Right. And if you had a booking agent. But before that, you were just trying to get a show on a... If you were playing on a Wednesday night, you were trying to get a show on a Thursday night next time.
Sure.
And that all was very organic. You just went and sat in the cafe until the booking agent walked by and you were like, hey.
Yeah.
Here's my demo. That made a kind of sense. And watching your band or anybody else's band go from playing for 50 people to 350 people.
Yeah.
It was very tangible. And you knew that screwing around with this effects pedal was going to translate to how the crowd responded when you stepped on it. And now I'm divorced from that a little bit. Although the show at the Showbox, you know, one thing Pete Nordstrom said at the end, because, you know.
That was all pre-done. You didn't bring out any new material for that, just to
be clear. No, it was all the old stuff.
Yeah.
But he said... You know, and I've been playing, he's been playing bass since the early 80s in rock bands. He said, I've never been on stage where the audience was singing along.
Mm.
And I didn't realize what a rush it is. Like what a huge part of the experience it is that you don't always get, right? You don't always end up having songs that, your fans know well enough to come to your shows and sing them at you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I shouldn't take for granted or I shouldn't be blasé about. And it's because I think of all those years in this town, at least, where I was playing for 50 people.
Yeah.
Because some of those people are still around. They still remember, you know, they'll stand out there and say, play that song from 1999.
You've written many amazing songs and there's just a Long Winters compilation that just came or a little bit of an anthology, which I'll link to in the show notes, as they say.
All of our records were re-released on vinyl just recently.
Yeah.
And they were part of the Bandbox debacle.
Yes.
Where they made beautiful editions, full color vinyl editions of all of our records, big splash.
Yeah. And took the money.
Took the money from everybody. sold out the whole run. Took the money. They actually, I don't know if you know this, but they actually made, I think on the sly, 200 copies additional each of the records and sold them too, although that wasn't the amount they told us.
So if it was a limited edition of 500, were there like two 498s or something, or who knows?
I don't know whether they were numbering them or what.
Okay.
But, and then they went bankrupt.
Yeah.
With the records made and sitting on a pallet in a warehouse somewhere. And now those records are part of a much larger bankruptcy proceeding.
Yeah. Here's my question though, is, you know, we hear these stories about Jackson Brown writing These Days when he was 16, or you younger, you know, writing Commander Thinks Aloud and all these, you know, you were in the moment, that was all you focused on, was making the greatest song you could. Do you feel like when you do these, whether it's a 1 hour challenge or whether you had a show and you needed to write a song later today, with your maturity, with where you're at in life, like, does it hit you? Does that 1 hour song hit you with the same depth? Does it feel different? Does it resonate with you as much? Or yeah, I'm just curious about that.
You know, in 1998, there was this group of us here.
Yeah.
Death Cab was, you know,
I was the go-to saw player for all of you.
We played a show with you in Sacramento, Death Cab, the Western State Hurricanes, and you on the saw.
Yeah.
Big, I think.
Old Ironsides.
Yeah. I think that was a hit. Right.
Yeah.
But we were, you know, we were in good natured competition with each other.
Yeah.
Sycophant was part of that group, although a little bit older than us, Nevada Bachelors, right? Yeah. There were a lot of bands then. And so when you'd sit and write a song, at least I would throw complications in that were really meant to make my fellow songwriters go, ooh.
Oh, okay.
Right? You're writing a song, you've got the tune, it's really cool, but you're going to shave a beat off of the bar in the turnaround.
It's a breadcrumb of sorts.
Yeah. And you're going to do it in such a way that the audience, I'm not a math rocker.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do it in a way that is all sprockets.
Yeah.
But I want to shave a beat off and make it feel seamless. But the musicians all go, oh, that was a bar of seven. And, or that, you know, or this, I used to screw with my own bandmates because I would, in the second verse, I would throw in a minor seven that wasn't in the first verse at all, so that the bass line no longer worked. You couldn't play the same bass line in the second verse that you played in the first.
Yeah.
Bo Gilliland, my bass player at the time, loved that challenge. He was like, God damn it, you know, screw you. I have this bass line that totally worked and now I have to completely, because he's, you know, like, I can't just change one note. I have to completely put it in this new key. And all of that was like a kind of sport for my fellows.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to play this. Then we're going to go into waltz time in the bridge, or we're going to do little bits. So especially when I went to play those Western State shows right before the pandemic.
Yeah.
I actually had the experience of relearning my tunes and going, why? Why is this? Why did you make this so hard? Like, you know, why are you reaching for this, like, Nuno Betancourt chord?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not, you're playing indie pop, you know? Look around, everybody's playing cowboy chords and you're throwing all these shapes. And it's because I wanted to be the one that threw these other songwriters not just a bone, but a challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm not fighting that battle, right? When I pick up a guitar, I am not trying to, because I'm not part of a community that's doing that. You know, I played, the first time I played Commander Thinks Aloud, it was on the acoustic guitar at a show at the EMP.
Huh.
And I was like, well, here's a new tune. And the show was me, John Vanderslice.
Yeah.
Ben, Jesse Sykes, I don't think Kathleen Edwards was there for that, but it was, you know, and we were all playing new songs at this show for reporters and stuff. And I'm like, here's the Commander Thinks Aloud. And I throw it out there and I'm like, this is my, you know, this song cannot help but resonate with the room. And then Ben, sitting to my left, says, here's my new song. It's I Will Follow You Into the Dark. And I had never heard him finger pick at that point. He'd never showed anybody that he could Travis pick.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's Travis picking, and all of a sudden it's I Will Follow You Into the Dark. And I'm like, you motherfucker. How the hell are you trumping me so hard? This is it's gonna end up being my masterwork. And then that ends up being their biggest single, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't know, but yeah.
I don't think they had a bigger single.
Yeah.
Which then produced their first platinum album.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of the 10 years that we spent writing songs back and forth, that was sort of the culmination of that.
That so maybe the competition is more important or whatever that switch is than the teen and 20-year-old emotions and yearning for love and all that stuff. Maybe it's more about just the nuts and bolts of competition.
Well, no, because all my songs were about how desperately I didn't understand why I couldn't put love together.
Okay.
Right? If you listen to the Long Winters catalog, it's every single note of it is why did this happen again?
Yeah.
Why am I in this situation again where I'm standing here alone in the rain where 2 months ago I really thought I had the world by the tail?
Yeah.
So the competition was just like just boys and boys playing with boys, but all the songs were just these mini, you know, little tragicomic operas.
Yeah.
I don't feel that way anymore. I don't have any questions about why all my relationships fucked up. I know exactly why. I know exactly why. And there's nothing to write about in that realm.
Yeah.
Right? I can't be like, why? It's like, yeah, I know, kid.
Yeah.
Keep crying. But I did realize that I could write, and Commander was not the first, but a song that when I played it, I could choke up at my own tune if I wasn't careful.
Yeah.
If I was lost in it, I could in front of a room full of people like break up a little.
Yeah.
And realizing the power of that over myself. Like I'm not trying to make the room cry.
Yeah.
But to make something that feels like, cuz to make something that makes you cry is really connected to that we're not the creators of these things. These songs come down out of the sky. Commander Thinks Aloud, I wrote in an hour and a half. It didn't belong to me, right? It was there. And I walked into it. And it feels like that. If you're writing a song about Boo Hoo Hoo, about my girlfriend Megan, that's you. But you write a song that connects with something that where you have an emotional reaction to that. It's that other, that's that other thing. These songs already existed. It's there's no reason you couldn't have written any one of my songs in ancient Greece on a three-string balalaika, because the songs were always there, right? It's a kind of quantum idea. We're just pulling them down, and that's what I want. That's a ridiculous standard of quality. You can't do that. You can't just, if we could do it, any one of us would do it.
Sure.
Let me just go sit in a chair and pull a song down from the quantum cloud of feeling. But I no longer feel like I have to, like I'm so confused. I now want to find things that really hit. And and in a way hurt. Either hurt with the, because the listener recognizes something in themselves. Like, oh, I know what that is. And that stings, right? That takes me out of whatever comfortable life I'm in and reminds me of that time that I didn't understand, right?
Yeah.
Or is just something, and I don't know if I've ever gotten even close to this, but it's just something that's universally true.
Yeah.
Because you hear those songs.
Yeah.
Where you're like, well, that's just a universe of this, that songwriter had to just step out of the way of that.
Yeah. John, we got to get you back on the podcast in a couple months.
Yeah, with some new songs.
Yeah, with some new songs.
Some new songs that all have a.
You can sit in this corner and debut them on the Fretboard Journal YouTube channel.
Look how many 10 watt amps you have over there. Is that a. What is that?
We'll end on that.
What is what?
Oh, so this.
All right, that was my chat with John Roderick of The Long Winters. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. It was great to catch up with John. We have a whole bunch of forthcoming podcast guests that you're not going to want to miss, including Molly Miller, Guru Singh is coming back on, and a lot of surprises. So stay tuned, subscribe if you haven't yet, and thanks as always for tuning in to the Fretboard Journal podcast.